This is In Focus, the weekly public affairs program from KTBB and the Team Sports Radio, featuring members of the local community working to make East Texas a better place.
And a good morning, everybody. Welcome to In Focus. I'm Roger Gray. Wonderful to have you with us. And this is an interview I have been looking forward to. My guest is the author, Stephen Harrigan. His latest book is called Sorrowful Mysteries. Welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much.
Appreciate you being here. But also, let me be the umpteenth Texan to tell you how much I absolutely love the Gates of the Alamo.
Oh, thank you so much.
As did just about all the readers in the New York Times. So.
Oh, well, yeah, that book is not 25 years old. It feels like it's not that old to me, but I just realized it was 25 years ago it was published.
Wow. Frankly, that surprises me, too. I'm amazed. Let me also say, as an intro to this book, Sorrowful Mysteries, we're about a year apart in age. I grew up in Houston. You grew up in Abilene. And after going through this book, I have never been so happy to have grown up an Episcopalian.
With a complicated world to grow up in Catholic in like the 1950s and 60s, for sure.
Indeed. But you identified something that I never had a name for, and that is the curiously lazy way Episcopalians kneel on the kneelers in church.
The Episcopal squat, my wife described it.
Yeah, I've never heard it called that, and it's absolutely perfect. What I'm describing, folks, is if you've been to a church that has, you know, fold-down kneelers on the pew in front of you, you kneel on them, but if you're lazy, you sort of sit your butt back on the edge of the pew. And you were told as a young Catholic boy that was wrong.
Well, not just told that. Our wrists were whacked by nuns patrolling the aisles with rulers. And so it was very much very much driven home that you did not put your elbows on the pews and you stayed upright, never, ever sort of sat down, like squatted back. You kept your knees on the rail and your elbows on the pews.
Indeed. Let's dive into this. Sorrowful Mysteries is about the shepherd, well, the subhead, the shepherd children of Fatima and the fate of the 20th century. Reading in the Texas Observer, a buddy of yours says, you originally intended just to do an article about the three children and the Fatima visions, right?
That's right. I kind of circled back to these memories of my childhood growing up as a young Catholic boy. And thought, you know, whatever happened, what was that story about that we heard about in Catholic school about the three children in 1917 in Portugal who said they saw the Virgin Mary and all the things that sort of emanated from that in terms of, you know, world events. And I thought, well, it'd be interesting to go to Fatima, write a, you know, 5,000-word article about it. But when I went there, I was confronted with so many of my own memories and so many impressions of what this event meant, not just to the Catholic faithful, of which I am really no longer one, but of the world itself. And so I thought there was a book here, and it's sort of a historical narrative of those events, and it's also a kind of memoir about growing up Catholic, you know, in mid-century America.
It feeds into all of the major faiths, let's be honest, the major world faiths, have an element of mystery about them. I guess that's why it's called faith, you know? And this feeds into the sense of mystery that, as you say, a young Catholic boy growing up was fascinated by.
Mm-hmm. And terrified by, because it all intersected with the Cold War, you know, with our fears of going to hell and all the kind of magic and mystery of the Catholic Church. So it was an overwhelming load of stuff, you know, that if you were an imaginative child, as these three children were in 1917, you were, you know, your circuits were flooded with mystery, basically. And you were susceptible to all sorts of potential visions and fears and things like that.
Well, let's talk about the event itself. As you mentioned, 1917, middle of World War I. In Portugal, three children, peasant children, shepherd children, Lucia, Jacinta, and Francisco. Mm-hmm. Tell us what happened.
Well, they were out. Lucia was 10 years old, very impressionable age, as I recall. You probably do, too, what it was like to be 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And she was out there with her cousins, Francisco and Jacinta. And this all comes from Lucia, mostly, because she was the one who lived to write about these events. The other two children, Francisco and Jacinta, died in the flu pandemic that happened the next year. So Lucia remembered and wrote about this and proclaimed about it, that the Virgin Mary basically showed up one day in this field and appeared to them and told them not to be afraid, that she would be coming back on the 13th of every month. This was May 13th, 1917. She would come back on the 13th of every month, and she told them all to pray for the rosary, to pray for peace, you know, and to you know, God was not pleased with the way things were going in the world. And incrementally each month, more and more people came to this field, although they couldn't see the apparition, only the children could. A lot of people believed it was happening. And by that sixth apparition, Lucia said that the Virgin had promised a miracle. And at that time, there were probably 60,000 people, maybe 70,000 people, mm-hmm. who came to the field during this tremendous rainstorm. Suddenly, the sky cleared. Lucia said, "Look at the sky." And everyone looked up, and depending on, you know, what you believe, who you believe, there was a miracle in the sky, in the sense that the sun began to move, or seemed to move, and it kind of seemed to drop out of the sky toward the earth. Exactly what happened, excuse me, is up to conjecture, mm-hmm. or up to faith, honestly. But some atmospheric event did happen that day, and you know, probably in my mind, can probably be explained by the sudden evaporation and the clearing of this rainstorm, and this and the sudden you know, how the sky can suddenly clear after a violent rainstorm, and everything seems sharp and almost miraculous looking. I think that's what happened. But to the people who believed and were expecting a miracle, this was absolute proof of it.
Well, and just to go back, because a lot happened, particularly in Lucia's life, but in all three kids' life, they didn't all see it at first. Poor Francisco got left out initially,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, kind of a girls' club. Yeah, he couldn't. He later said he saw it, but couldn't hear the Virgin. And, you know, again, these were little kids. You have to put yourself in the, you know, I watch my grandchildren now and how impressionable they are, and how much they believe mm-hmm. anything could happen. And, you know, again, it depends on which side of the faith divide you are on this. I mean, many people, of course, absolutely believe the veracity of everything the children said. Other people, you know, are still moved by it like I am, but don't believe in the literalness of the event. But they, the children were the only ones who claimed to see the Virgin, and everyone else had to take their word for it, basically. And this was at a time when Portugal itself was in a tremendous upheaval politically, and Catholicism was being suppressed. So there was a lot at stake, both politically, culturally, and in terms of the children's lives, very personally, because Lucia's families, it was the grazing land of their sheep and where they grew their crops, where this happened. And the pilgrims, who showed up there destroyed their livelihood, basically, by trampling all these fields into mud.
Yeah, their crops, the grazing pasture for the sheep, it was all ruined. And as you say, Portugal at the time was becoming more and more secular. Mm-hmm. And these kids, when word of what they said they saw got out, they were tormented to a certain extent. Inquisition, yeah. Probably too harsh a word, but the authorities really questioned them, you know, threatened to lock them up.
Yeah. I mean, they were kidnapped, you know, and I mean, they claimed that they were threatened with being boiled alive in oil. I think that's an exaggeration, but I think they were clearly afraid. And, you know, they were a serious threat to a government that was trying to, you know, become, you know, to establish a secular presence in Portugal, secular government. And again, this is at the time of the rise of Russian communism. You know, the First World War, you know, all sorts of, you know, economic upheaval in Portugal. So there's a lot at stake. And the last thing this new Republican government needed was this sort of resurgence of a you know, Catholic belief system that they were trying to quell.
And a particularly mystical version of Catholicism. Yeah,
exactly.
Involving visions.
Very, very much like Lourdes or La Salette or any of the kind of famous pilgrimage sites that we know of today. I mean, yeah, people were aware of you know, appearances or, you know, apparitions in other places in Europe at the time. Yeah. And sort of, you know, that's sort of what they expected to see if they were devout Catholics and were kind of had that mystical dimension.
And we should mention Lourdes was, that was Bernadette, a film has been made of it, famous film.
Yeah.
It was in 1858, and this was, you know,
1917. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, she promised. There were three, and this is where it gets interesting to me anyway. She promised three, basically prophecies, I guess we would call it.
Yeah, there were, on one of the apparitions, Lucia said that the Virgin had given them three secrets with the children. One was a vision of hell, which was very familiar to kids of my age. You know, one was basically a command to pray the rosary, and they didn't seem like secrets. But
yeah.
The third was such a secret that no one could, the Lucia and the kids would not reveal it, which is one of the reasons they were kidnapped and you know, threatened.
Mm-hmm.
But they wouldn't reveal it. And of course, everybody was immensely curious about it, what this secret was. And Lucia was talked into writing it down in the 1940s.
Yeah.
And so after going through some serious health issues where she thought she was going to die.
And by the way, she became a nun.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
She became a nun, lived till she was 97 as a cloistered Carmelite nun. But this was, you know, she was much younger. And when she wrote this thing, which we're now called either the Third Secret of Fatima, or as we know it as kids, the Fatima Letter.
Mm-hmm.
So what we were told was, when I was in Catholic school, and that Lucia had written this thing called the Fatima Letter. She had sent it to the Pope. It was supposed to be opened in 1960, and it was a prophecy. It would be a prophecy that would tell basically our fate. It would tell the future of the world. And remember, this was at the height of the Cold War, you know, a few years before the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right.
We were all doing duck and cover exercises in school, you know, getting under our desks with the atom bombs or the hydrogen bombs started falling. And so, you know, everybody was very curious and kind of on pins and needles to see what would be revealed when 1960 came. And we were told, and I've talked to other Catholic kids of my age, they were told as well that the Pope read the letter when 1960 happened. Excuse me. And said it was too terrible for anybody to know and put it back in the envelope and sent it to the Vatican archives.
That was John the 23rd, I think, right?
John the 23rd.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we were horrified. We thought, well, our fate was sealed. You know, it's just going to be, the bombs are going to start falling.
Yeah, the Russians
and
are,
so,
yeah.
Right, yeah. I mean, everything would seem like it was at stake at that moment. And, you know, I kind of forgot about it, you know, as most kids did, I think. But finally, in 2000, the letter was opened and revealed to the public, and it was not so much a prophecy as a kind of vision that Lucia wrote down. And it's not very long, and it's very very dreamlike, in which she envisions the Pope being gunned down and killed. Well, in the 64th anniversary of the first apparition of Fatima, the Pope gets gunned down. He's shot in St. Peter's Square by a Turkish assassin. And he survives, Pope John Paul II, he survives. But
it was a Mehmet Ali Aja,
That's right. And you know, the Pope's directive at that point is, let me see that letter again. And he reads it, and he realizes, at least in his mind, that the Virgin Mary had altered the path of the bullet, which spared his vital organs and saved his life. And so he took the bullet, gave it to the Bishop of Fatima, told him, this is a gift from Our Lady. And the bullet was then taken to Fatima itself and welded into the crown of the statue of Our Lady of Fatima.
And we should mention that they built a chapel there and all the as they did at Lourdes and so forth.
Right. Mm-hmm. And more than any other, there's a chapel there called the Chapel of the Apparitions, which is the spot at which, you know, Lucia said the Virgin appeared. But the whole field and that grazing area is now a gigantic religious complex with, basilicas and monasteries and, convents and, innumerable gift shops.
But Stephen, I have to say, given that indeed the Pope was shot, and that's what the letter said that she wrote back in the 40s. Does that not at least pique your curiosity?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But, then you have to look at what the letter actually said, which was that he was, was in the letter, he's depicted as being in a ruined city, it's been sort of devastated, and he's shot with by guns and arrows, and he dies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, those are significant differences. A, he didn't die.
Right.
B, he was shot only with one gun, and C, he was in St. Peter's Square and not in this sort of apocalyptic setting. But it certainly echoes something important. And what was so interesting to me was how it how these events of Fatima just sort of track with so many of the major events of the 20th century. The pandemic of 1918, the flu pandemic, and I wrote this book in the wake of the COVID pandemic, so I was very aware of the historical echoes that I was writing about, and what drew me to it more than anything was the lives of these three children. Two of those lives cut very short because they were infected with the flu
and
died lingering death. Yeah, and then of Lucia, who lived throughout that century, and whose prophecies and whose prayers and whose concerns were all wrapped up with the rise of communism, with world wars, with assassinations. So it felt like you could kind of overlay what all the events of Fatima onto a timeline of the 20th century, and there would be a lot of connection.
When you pointed out, she also to add to a skeptic's point of view here, she predicted things by the 40s that had already happened. Whether it's World War One, World War Two, et cetera.
Right. Yeah, I mean.
Which I can do that. I can tell you won the Super Bowl.
I'm not sure that she knew. I mean, again, she was like, you have to remember, she was a 10-year-old girl who was, I think, imagining these events. Other people will, disagree with me about that. But she was, she was very preoccupied with what was going on in her village and in her country, and this war was a terrible war in which 100,000 Portuguese troops were serving at the Western Front and in other places, and her own brother was likely to be called up, so she was horrified and afraid, and I think she was looking to the Virgin Mary as all Catholics do and did for consolation and for hope. And so that's what she wanted to hear, was that the World War One would end this week, you know, or that unless people, you know, prayed the rosary, another terrible war would start on such and such a date, which was World War II, but she had the dates wrong.
Yeah.
if you're a devout, believer in Fatima and Catholicism and everything entailed, you're probably not going to quibble with the dates, but you're going to sort of focus on the essence of what she was saying.
Well, it's sort of like John Paul II being shot as well. I mean, yes, okay, it was like a dream sequence in the prophecy, but somebody did shoot the Pope. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, and on that date, on May 13th, yeah. Which is very significant. Yeah.
We should also point out, these kids were cousins. Lucia's father was generally accepting of her vision, although he was a troubled man in many ways, drank too much, etc. Jacinta and Francisco's parents were very accepting, while Lucia's mother actually beat her.
Yeah, with a broom. Her mother was a very interesting character. She was very devout. And was could read at a time when 92% of the women in rural Portugal couldn't read, and endlessly helpful to her neighbors, and when the pandemic came, she made herself and her husband go out and go to all these houses and help people. She was a very remarkable person. But very headstrong, just like her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And she did not believe Lucia. And, again, if your 10-year-old daughter comes home and says, I saw the Virgin Mary, or I saw, Taylor Swift appeared to me, children are imaginative. So she was not inclined to believe her. And then when everything started to go bad in the family, in terms of her husband's drinking and the economics of the family economics going south, I mean, she really was angry and wanted Lucia to recant. But, Lucia wouldn't, because she believed what she had seen.
And you say you believe the secular authorities kind of went too far in dealing with these kids.
Yeah, I mean, they were pretty hard-bitten secular authorities who were trying to suppress what they considered superstition, and trying to create a different kind of Portugal that was, that was more forward-looking, depending on your perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And one of essentially the mayor of a nearby town, basically, wanted to put a stop to all these apparitions and all these people, appearing at this field. And so he kidnapped the kids before one of the scheduled apparitions, so that it wouldn't happen.
Yeah,
and he held them in his house for a couple of days.
Yeah, the third visit was delayed by that. But
right.
they claim she ultimately did visit them a couple of days later.
Yeah, and they lived in a little town called Aljustrel, and just a few, a couple hundred yards from that town, this place called Valinos, they say the Virgin appeared to them there, kind of as a do-over.
But as any good writer would, you decided, in addition to all of this, to go there. What was that experience like for you?
Phenomenal. It was... you can't write about Fatima without going there. I mean, it's just, it's an overpowering experience, particularly if you've done some research and know what you're looking for. And I wasn't prepared for the flood of emotions that overcame me while I was there. Part of the flood of emotions was nostalgia for me, sort of being thrown back into the religion I had grown up with. And where everything seemed so familiar, but most of it was again, it came back to these three children. I went in Lisbon. I went to the hospital where Jacinta died. In Aljustrel, I went to the room where Francisco died. And in Coimbra, you know, another city in Portugal, I went to the convent where Lucia spent the last 70 something years of her life. And all of those experiences were overpowering to me because I had felt like I'd gotten to know these children. I cared about them. And to see, to sort of see the places where they lived and died was really meaningful. And then to be at Fatima itself, which is a gigantic pilgrimage site where 5 million people every year come, and to see people shuffling along on their knees to the Chapel of the Apparitions, to see them singing and parading or with candles, and it was really moving. And I think anyone who goes there and has an open mind, not necessarily an open mind about exactly what happened, but about the idea that humans are sort of drawn to the supernatural in one way or another, you can't fail to be moved. And it's just an overpowering sensation.
And in doing this book, you write that you confronted your own feelings about the faith you grew up in.
Exactly. I mean the book is partly a memoir of my my apostasy in some ways, or my
well, we all went through the 60s, we're the same age.
I mean, and it's I grew away from Catholicism, but I could never quite consider myself cured of it, if that's the right phrase. I've been telling my people, who have read this book, or who want to know where I came out on the other side of writing is, I feel like I'm a non-believing, non-practicing Catholic. The Catholicism is so deeply encoded within my being, that it's hard for me to expunge it, and I'm not sure I want to, it was a kind of, writing the book was an experience of confronting what I believed, what I didn't believe, but accepting, I think, in a way that I hadn't quite before, how necessary it is for most people to believe something, and whether that's the literal, truth of the Gospels, or whether it's the sense that the universe is very big and mysterious. I mean, we all have that, that yearning to confront, the unknowable. And so that this was a book was a way of putting me back in that zone in a way, without having me, re-engage with my childhood religion, but to give me a new appreciation of what that religion is, or what any religion is.
Well, and we've only got a minute or so left, but you say fairly early in the book, actually, that you really don't buy it, that it was almost, not really a childhood fantasy, but...
Yeah, I'm a skeptic for sure. I mean, because I believe what happened was, a sequence of events that started with the imagination of a 10-year-old girl and her two cousins, and grew and grew and grew. But there's a profundity in that. Even if you don't believe it, there's a power in it that you can't turn away from. You have to accept that these children, in a way, the story of Fatima is a story of the power of imagination, and the childhood imagination of human imagination. And, it's just, that was what was so interesting to write about for me.
All right. Stephen Harrigan. The book is Sorrowful Mysteries. It's the story of Our Lady of Fatima and about you as well. A great read. Like everything else you've written, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Roger. It's great to talk.
And thank all of you for joining us. And this program will be on our website after it airs. And we will see you next week.
In Focus is a weekly public affairs program featuring members of the local community working to make East Texas a better place. In Focus is produced by KTBB and the Team Sports Radio. And we thank you for listening. Join us again next week.